Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Sorghum is utilized in a lot of different areas, and one thing that I'm really thankful for is the versatility of it.
McPherson, Kansas sorghum producer Kim Baldwin.
We have ethanol plants that we can easily send our sorghum to in central Kansas, but there's some really cool emerging markets and opportunities for sorghum and sorghum producers from the pet food industry, obviously human food and that food industry, aquaculture. So it's not necessarily just something that you feed the hogs or the cows, as part of their ration anymore. There's just a lot of opportunities, and I'm just excited that, there are potential markets that are going to be including some sorghum.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
By and large, saw a little bit lower prices here this last week.
Tyler Cousins is director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
5 to 6 weights were about $3.43. That's down about 2.5% over $8, almost $9. 6 to 7 weights were at $3.13. That's actually down about 3% or about $9 from the prior week. 7 to 8 weights were $2.78. That's down almost $3, about 1% from the prior week. 8 to 9 weights, $2.67. That's down about 2.5%, or about $7 from a week ago. And then those 900 to 1,000 pound steers were $2.44. That's actually a pretty good drop there, about $15, almost 6% from last week. But I think we look at those steer feeder cattle prices compared to a year ago, we're looking at some pretty strong gains compared to a year ago, over upwards of $30, almost $40 compared to a year ago. So that's about 16 to almost 17% increase. Now looking on the heifer side, the weight breakdowns there, 5 to 6 weights were $300. That's down about 6%. 6 to 7 weights were $275.50. That's down less than 1% from last week. 7 to 8 weights were $255, $256 roughly. That's slightly below where it was last week. 8 to 9 weights for heifers were $231. That's down about $6 from the prior week, but still compared to a year ago, seeing some pretty strong gains there on those feeder heifer prices there.
And moving to overall meat demand, we have final numbers from 2024.
So a quick takeaways here. Beef demand, based on some of the matrices and statistics that we look at, beef demand fared well in 2024 despite the higher retail prices. On the pork side, pork demand, relative demand profile for pork held steady with last year, tracking closely with what was seen in 2023. On the chicken side, generally speaking, chicken demand at the retail level was stronger as it is a relatively cheaper meat option in the meat case. But I think we also have to keep in mind that January and February, as we start 2025 here, these tend to be some of the weaker demand months in the year for meat, largely because we're in the middle of winter. So people are inside more and there is less outdoor grilling. As we get into more of the springtime, typically we'll start to see, just demand for meat increase as people are outside enjoying the nicer weather. And so that kind of starts the grilling season, which is kind of unofficially around that Memorial Day timeframe there. So kind of one of those things we're looking at from just an overall demand picture for meat as we move into 2025 here.
Now, the industry has also been dealing with fewer feeder cattle. Why?
Back in November, if you may recall, there was a reported case of New World screw worm in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas. That was in late November there, and USDA suspended the imports of cattle and bison from Mexico at that time. And since then, we have not seen any cattle or any livestock imports from Mexico. Now, there has been new protocol that has been put in place and agreed upon between both Mexico and the U.S. to ensure the protection of U.S. cattle and livestock. One quick note, as a part of this new protocol that was signed between the two countries, Mexico identified and prepared free export inspection pens on the Mexican side of the border. APHIS has visited, inspected, and improved these facilities. And so now we're starting to see cattle move through these pre-export inspection pens. USDA reported last week that actually 1,400 head of cattle were imported from Mexico. So this actually marks the first reported importation of cattle from Mexico since the mid-November detection of New World screw worm when USDA closed the border there. Now moving forward, it's likely that cattle imports from Mexico will be slow as the new protocol between the U.S. and Mexico still gets a little bit more implemented there. So there's still going to be a throttle effect of the flow of cattle here for a bit here until they get some of the stuff sorted out here. But overall, this is still a very fluid situation that will likely continue to evolve as the U.S. and Mexico work through the protocol and ensure the safety of U.S. cattle supplies.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Just want to keep in mind, world production was increased slightly by USDA as production was up just over 500,000 metric tons, taking it to just under 794 million metric tons. That's up slightly from a year ago, and that is a record production number.
Dr. Guy Allen, senior economist at the IGP Institute.
That said, things do appear to be tight in some particularly major exporting countries. We'll sort of run through that. We'll start out here with Russia. Russian production was forecast. It was unchanged. Exports also unchanged. This is for last year, 53 million metric tons. Production was unchanged for this year. However, exports were dropped 500,000 tons to 45.5 million metric tons. That's 10 million metric tons less than last year's record. Sorry, that was a production number. Moving on to Ukraine. Ukraine production forecast is at just under 23 million metric tons, unchanged from last month, but reduced by 500,000 metric tons to 15.5 on the exports. That's 3.1 million metric tons lower than last year. So combined exports out of Russia and the Ukraine are forecast to decline 13.1 million metric tons. And that's what I think is lending some of that support to U.S. wheat exports on that. Moving on to let's have a quick look at the Southern Hemisphere. Argentina crop was increased just 0.2 million metric tons to 17.7, but they left exports steady. Looking at my friends down in Australia, their crop was unchanged at 32 million metric tons, and exports were steady at 25. So combined Australia and Argentina, their exports are up 8.4 million metric tons from last year. So some of that we're losing out of the Black Sea will pick up in Southern Hemisphere. Moving north to our Canadian neighbors, they're basically unchanged, production at 35 and exports at 26. Now, the big swing, and that's on the demand side, on the Chinese estimate, it came in unchanged. Keep in mind, China's the second largest wheat producer in the world, 140 million metric tons. But imports were lowered 2.5 million metric tons down to 8 million metric tons. That's a five-year low. So I've actually been quite happy that the U.S. wheat exports have been at least at the pace that they're at on that. Wheat feeding in China is estimated, it's down to 33 million metric tons compared to 37 last year. That's a drop in 4 million metric tons. So they're tightening up that premium for wheat domestically.
Now let's turn to the supply-demand balance sheet for sorghum. Dan O'Brien, Kansas State grain marketing economist.
It looks like the USDA, they saw their export situation was really, really weak. In fact, so they lowered it 50 million bushels, total sales of 46.3 million bushels, 26% of the way to their forecast, 175, and they dropped that 50 in that report. Yes. And 44% of the way through the market here. So they're really trailing. So when they took that 50 out for sorghum, they said, well, we just got to go somewhere. So they put that over into feed use, food use. And I think they're counting on low price sorghum to compete. Now, what you said may come into play in that if corn tightens up, then here's a bunch of sorghum sitting here available at pretty low price. And if anything, market forces may change this around, but we're waiting for that to happen so far.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So how is it that we're spending, you know, these large, expected to spend these large sums in, 26, 27 and beyond?
Jonathan Kappas, University of Illinois, farm policy expert, former administrator for the Farm Service Agency.
And a lot of it is due to how the price loss coverage program works. And that is Congress sets a fixed price. Let's take wheat, for example. Wheat's reference price is $5.50. If during the course of the 12-month marketing year following wheat harvest, the national average price received by farmers is below that $5.50, we trigger payments. And so when CBO does their calculations, they estimate, you know, they forecast, they use USDA forecasts and others to try to get an estimate of where prices are going to be over this long, long 10-year window. And here you can see in particular wheat expected to be below its reference price in the out years, so 26 and beyond. And that's triggering a large amount of those payments. Soybeans, by comparison, is expected to stay well above its reference price of $8.40 and likely not to trigger any payments. Corn's a little bit closer to that reference price, so it's feeding some expectations of spending there, but not a lot. By comparison, looking at our other three major crops and major both in terms of acreage, but also in terms of the political influence, if you will, or political footprint in these discussions. If we look at our southern crops, cotton, rice, and peanuts, we can see quite a bit of difference in the way the PLC program operates for these crops. So all three of them are expected to be below their reference prices in the out years. Now, again, this is likely to adjust when CBO re-forecasts. But peanuts, I think, is probably the one that jumps out the most. And it was projected in May to be well below its reference price. So the expectations in this program would be payments every year and large payments for peanuts, which if we take the expected outlays that CBO projected back in May and we divide it by the number of base acres that are in the program, this is what it looks like year over year, crop by crop. The main takeaway here is the importance of where that reference price is set. It's also a reminder of this baseline challenge because rice and peanuts are the smallest crops in the program. So if you increase their reference price, you can spend a lot more money per acre on those crops and those farmers who have base acres of those crops, but it doesn't show up in the baseline the same way. And this is, you know, a bit of a challenge for crops like corn and soybeans. Soybeans in particular, if we go back up here a minute, if soybeans want to move that reference price closer to where the forecasted prices are going to be, we're talking 50, 60 million acres potentially expected in that program, which is going to spend a lot more money in the baseline and be extraordinarily costly over a 10-year window. And so it challenges these larger crops under this baseline sort of zero-sum game that they cannot as easily increase the trigger points for program payments because they're paying out on such large acreage. And large acreage with payments over 10 years is extraordinarily expensive in the baseline. So this is, if you will, this is sort of a rough perspective around some of the politics at the committee level in particular, around how these programs are created, how we negotiate things like the fixed reference price in the statute, kind of who wins and loses in that undertaking. And certainly, you know, these politics break out on the regional lines because the southern crops are getting these larger payments every year. And, you know, their membership is more likely wanting to protect that or improve that. And so these are some of the indicators of the political challenges that we'll see at the committee level in particular. A lot of this won't get worked out on a floor debate because it's pretty deep in the weeds of the policy, but it certainly is something that the committees will work a lot on.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
U.S. dollar's a bit lower this week. It looks like it could drop below 107.
Dr. Guy Allen's a senior economist at the IGP Institute. What about freight rates?
We're looking as we're approaching a two-year low on that. We're down to about 776, which that's a good thing that freight's getting cheaper. It helps helps the U.S. commodities compete where we're freight disadvantaged. The downside of that is I think it's a reflection of the poor health of the global economy, because not only is grain, it's an indication of grain exports aren't moving as much as we'd like, but particularly coal and iron ore on that. Surprisingly, U.S. exports have been fairly good as we move forward, even with the absence of China. But freight index has come down. It's come down to levels when it drops below 1,000. I start to get a bit worried because it tends to be a leading indicator of global economic health. That just sort of overlays the environment here as we move to talking into the USDA report.
Dan O'Brien's a Kansas State grain marketing economist.
When you look at the last 3 years for major exporters, 2 years ago, their stocks to use at the end of the year was about 13.9%. So, okay, got that. Then the last year, that dropped to about 11.6%. And this year, projected to be about 9.85. So supplies for exporters are tightening up. We're not even through that last marketing year. And on the importer side, of course, it's a little more stable, but still declining. You got 53% stocks to use basically 2 years ago, about 50% stocks to use 2 years ago, then 48% this year. So even though the world wheat market sort of just limping along and not any great shakes, still you've got these key groups that are showing that things are tightening up. And on the overall picture, you still have world minus China stocks, 21% 2 years ago, 20.6% last year, 19.5% this year. So I understand we're stable. We're not terribly worried. Then we don't have we have wars going on, but we're not really worried about what the impact they have at this, apparently in the grain markets. But we are tightening up in that wheat market, and I just wonder where we'll go in the future.
What about corn?
There was no change in the supply-demand balance sheet this month. And why? Well, in January, they had the new production numbers out here. And at the end of March, they'll have the February 1st stocks numbers. And so far for corn, we've had really pretty good weeks of exports. Been moving pretty well. And as I understand it, ethanol usage of corn doing decently. In fact, just on a side note on that, Kansas trails Ohio, Indiana, Illinois in terms of the corn price being paid at ethanol plants. And when you look at the drought map in those areas, it's drier out there. So I think there's probably some aspect to that. Hey, where these ethanol plants are trying to get ahead of supplies when they see a dry situation. Point being that pretty strong exports for corn, and we're bought ahead to the degree that we're at 75% of the USDA's projection at 2.45 billion bushels, and with only about 44% of the way through the market here, about 23 weeks. So we're doing pretty good. The only change that did happen in that balance sheet was that they did raise the price of corn from 425 to 435 for the season average price. And that's just following, I think, what's happened in the futures. And we have had a run up here in late January. Have tended to basically bounce around $4.90, up and down that about 5-6 cents, 5-7 cents each day for corn. And of the commodities so far here of late, corn has been as strong as about anything, as strong and consistent.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We passed some data that just came out as far as retail prices go.
Tyler Cousins is director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
We're kind of breaking down some of that discussion here, looking on the beef side of things. So the retail beef price in January was reported at $8.53 per pound. That's actually an increase of about 5.5% from last year, and actually the highest on record. So we actually saw a record retail beef price in January. Also want to note, USDA also reports an all fresh retail beef price, which was actually $8.15 per pound, $8.15. That's an increase of just over 4% from last year. January's all fresh retail beef price ranks within the top five highest monthly prices reported by USDA ERS. Now, a quick note on the two retail beef prices from USDA. USDA defines the retail beef price as the average retail prices for the selected product as reported by BLS, where USDA defines the all-fresh retail beef price as the composite value based on choice beef, other beef, and hamburger retail prices developed to estimate the average retail value of total beef production. So the main takeaway from this is that each retail beef price aggregates individual beef cuts data slightly differently. Regardless, both retail beef prices are indicating rising beef prices at the retail level. So looking a little bit more at some of these beef prices, ground beef was actually $5.82 per pound in January. That's up just over 6% from last year. Roast increased 6% from last year to $7.72 per pound in January. And steaks actually rose almost 3% in January to $11.79. So almost that $12 mark for that steaks there. So overall, on the beef side, the start to 2025 retail beef prices have held strong in January, which follows the trend that was quite frankly was started in the fourth quarter of 2024. Now switching over to the pork side of things, in January the retail pork price was $4.95 per pound, which was an increase of just over 3% from last year. Looking a little bit more at some of those retail pork prices, bacon was actually $7.04 per pound in January. That's up almost 7% from the previous year. And actually, the last time bacon was above $7 per pound was October of 2023, when it was $7.22 per pound. Pork chops in January increased marginally, less than 1% from the prior year, to $4.25 per pound in January. Hams were $4.41 per pound in January, which was even with last year's price. So main takeaway on the pork side of things, retail pork prices continue to hold just below $5, kind of that $5 mark there. So as we get into 2025 here, an item to watch will be to see if those retail pork prices crest that $5 per pound mark. The last time retail pork prices were above $5 per pound was October of 2023. Then that was $5.04 per pound. Now moving over to some discussion on retail prices for chicken. couple of things to note there on the January whole bird price, whole bird chicken price was 206 per pound, which was unchanged from December of 2024. But compared to a year ago, it was actually up almost 4%. USDA also reports a composite retail chicken price, which increased fractionally from last year by less than 1% to $2.43 per pound. And a quick note on the composite retail chicken price, USDA defines this as the retail value of the composite wholesale value for broilers. So it's an aggregate of wholesale chicken cuts to get a representative retail price. So overall retail prices for both beef, pork, and chicken appear to be continuing to hold strong going into 2025, which follows a trend in relative stronger prices that started in 2024. The looming concern, though, as we start 2025, is turning more towards just meat demand at these, you know, as I'd indicated, record beef prices. And so, consumers' appetite and willingness to pay at these prices is a looming concern as we start 2025 here.
This is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Most of the things they're calling for in this bill are already being done, have been done for years, as far as audits and checkups, making sure that none of the money goes directly to finance organizations that are going to affect public policy, legislation. That's all already being done.
Groups like Farm Action, Civil Eats, Heritage Foundation, and some members of Congress calling for an end to checkoffs. Steve Dittmer is with the Ag Freedom Foundation.
And of course, we pointed out Mike Lee and Rand Paul are two senators who normally are very committed free market guys, promote liberty and freedom, and what they're doing hanging out with the likes of Senator Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker, I have no idea, because they are obviously very left-leaning liberal senators. Booker has put out a plan that would basically outlaw all confined animal feeding in the country, phase it out over a couple of years. I can't imagine. We think we've seen supply chain problems the last couple of years in agriculture, and especially in the beef industry. I can't imagine what we would go through if we no longer had any of the major feed yards. But that's the kind of thing that he's thinking about. And so I really don't understand why they're working together, and I don't understand why they're trying to, quote-unquote, reform the checkoff. We went through this about a 2 or 3 year process with RKF suing USDA and the checkoff, starting in Montana and working its way through the courts. And the only major changes that were made is some of the checkups and checkoffs and auditing procedures that had been done for years were codified into some more regulations at USDA. And the courts ended up deciding that the checkoff was constitutional, it was being run properly, it wasn't a problem. It cost the NCBA, who has to do the legal stuff. This is a separation of powers. The checkoff is beef promotion, research, and education. They can't get involved in legislation. NCBA had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars with lawyers fighting these court battles in order to prove the checkoff was doing what it was supposed to do. We also had a referendum or a petition for a referendum a couple of years ago, and it never got anywhere near enough signatures to bring a referendum. And I think one of the things that people miss about the beef checkoff, this isn't a government program that was handed down to us or mandated or anything like that. Cattlemen across the country went into their offices and voted this checkoff in 1985 or 86. I forget exactly which year. But it was something they voluntarily decided they wanted to do to promote their industry, to provide the nutrition research, the health research, to fight the don't eat animal products movement that started in the 70s with Senator McGovern. They wanted to be able to do this themselves, to do national advertising, to do educational work, and it's been immensely successful. And if you look at the money that the checkoff has put into the U.S. meat export operation, we're approaching $500 a head for the fed animal, a value from beef exports alone, besides the boost in domestic beef demand. and those kind of things are critically important.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, we've got roughly 90 employees outside the U.S. in about 19 different regions around the world.
Dan Hallstrom, President and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
It's relationship-based, and it's a matter of developing those relationships, telling our story. We have a great production ag story, whether it's beef, pork, or lamb. And we're out there each and every day working with the trade and working with our U.S. exporters to tell our story. And, you know, we have a very high-quality product, very consistent product, a very safe product. And those three attributes, you know, not all of our global competition can rest on those laurels like we can. So we're out there every day telling that story and hopefully telling it in a way that results in opportunities for increased business.